On this edition of the Scott Radley Show podcast, we are talking about housing in the city. How much new housing stock do we need to catch up? Well, a new report is out and it tells us. We'll tell you what it is. We're talking about the Holocaust, which is kind of bleak, I understand. But another survey is out of kids, of school kids in Canada. And their knowledge of this is distressing. We will talk about that. And we will talk about football, Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers, and the other guys. We'll talk about stuff to do with retirement, with who's still the best, who would you draft if you were starting order, lots of stuff. Stick around.
Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
There's a report that was done for a group that's called the Smart Prosperity Institute, which is a national research network and policy think tank based out of the University of Ottawa. And it was looking into housing in Southern Ontario, mainly the Greater Toronto Area and Hamilton, and looking at what is needed to start resolving some of the problems we're having. And what it discovered and what it decided was the solution to this is we, Hamilton, need 30% more housing units every year than what we're doing to meet demand. 30% more. I mean, that is a staggering number when you start considering what that would mean in terms of practical, as far as being able to build 30% more housing units. Now, we know that council has capped the urban boundary, so growth won't be going outwards. It's going to be going up. So the question is, how do we do that? Because that sounds like a very daunting number. I want to bring in Mike Collins-Williams, who's the CEO of the West End Home Builders Association. Mike, how are you this evening?
Hi, Scott. I'm doing great. Thank you for having me.
Excellent. You know, when I say 30%, Mike, I must tell you, that sounds like a really daunting number.
It's definitely going to be a challenge, not just in Hamilton, because Hamilton is not an island onto itself. Essentially, we are in a broad region, the Greater Toronto and Hamilton area, and in a large area, the Greater Golden Horseshoe, that is in the midst of a housing crisis. Those are strong words, but I think we've all seen how fast housing prices have risen, how much people are struggling to pay rent or to be able to afford a home. And I think something that we're seeing a lot more in the last few years is a bit of a mass migration. There's a bit of an exodus occurring of young families who are giving up on whether it's Toronto or Hamilton, and they're voting with their feet, and they are leaving for communities that were never forecasted or planned to experience the kind of growth that they're experiencing today.
Do we know, do we have good numbers on, when we talk about 30%, that's 30% of what? Do we know what the numbers are for how many units are being built every year in the city?
Hamilton, depending on the year, will build between 3,000 and 4,000 units. The broader region, the Greater Toronto Area, usually averages between 40 and 45,000 units a year. Wow. And across Ontario, it really fluctuates. 1995 was a low in the recession of around 35,000 units. Typically in Ontario, it's around 65 to 75,000 units. Last year, I believe, was a record just about since the early 80s, hitting 100,000 units a year. But that same think tank that you're referring to, Smart Prosperity Institute, headed up by Dr. Mike Moffitt, did a previous report to the one that you're that we're talking about today, that's forecasted to meet demand. Ontario needs to build 1 million homes over the next decade. And that's sort of where that 30% number comes from.
Yeah.
Communities across the province have to make a significant jump to meet population growth.
Here's the thing. I don't know everything about developers, but I know one thing about developers. They want to develop. And so if there's this massive need and there's this desire for developers to build places, why aren't we seeing the output that would keep up with this need that we have?
That's a great question. And there's a few different reasons for that. The report that was just released earlier today by the Smart Prosperity Institute looks at some of the foundational items in terms of how we plan for growth. So the forecasts of population growth and housing completions that are the foundation on which municipalities, such as Hamilton, base their projections for future housing requirements, and the growth plan that the province has seeks to manage growth by determining how much housing gets built, where it gets built, and how dense it is. But if the forecasts that inform that plan are inaccurate and they're not up to date, then we're going to end up with a huge mismatch between housing supply and demand. And that's really what's happened in the last few years. One key statistic that really jumps off the page from this report is that over the last 5 years, we did not forecast an additional 120,000 people that came to Hamilton and the Greater Toronto Area through international sources. So this is increased immigration and changes in non-permanent residences that sort of encouraged international students to come to institutions like McMaster. Mm-hmm. So there's been a massive jump that was never included in these forecasts that we have based our growth planning on. And that's created a problem, and that's contributed to the rapid escalation in housing crisis.
And look, I know whenever we'd have this discussion, you and me or me and anyone else has this discussion, some will say, well, you're slamming immigration. You're being anti-immigration. It's not about slamming immigration. It's about the reality that more people need more places to live. We can have the immigration. You just have to have the plans for where you're going to put people. It's not about saying close the borders, but it goes beyond that, because here in Hamilton, and you know, we just had this long, very passionate debate about the urban boundary expansion. And in that discussion, we heard, and we've heard this before, that apparently by 2050, we are going to have in this city, we are told, another 230,000 people in Hamilton. And honestly, I'm looking at this and I'm looking at the numbers and I'm the 30% and everything else. Even if you build, and I did a little math today, so forgive me for my math, but if you build a high rise with 100 units in it, to cover 230,000 people, if we assume families of four and not singles and not doubles, and which is being generous because we know that's not the case, you'd have to build 575 high rises in the next 10 years or 20 years. That seems impossible.
And those are the minimum targets. So the targets that the city was looking at throughout this whole debate as to where we're going to grow and how we're going to grow may be inaccurate. And that's this report that was just released from the Smart Prosperity Institute is suggesting that these forecasts are wrong and we've been forecasting for failure because we've been underestimating the volume of growth. So despite all the challenges of the debate in Hamilton over the last number of months, we could be off significantly because those forecasts did not account for changes to immigration, which the newly elected federal government has increased immigration to 400,000 a year. And last year, in 2021, for the first time since Confederation in 1867, Canada brought in more people than all of the United States, a country nine times our size. And to your point earlier, immigration's good. For the industry that I represent, the development new housing industry, it is the lifeblood of our labor supply. You know, in previous decades, it was immigrants from Eastern Europe that really built Hamilton through the 50s, 60s,
absolutely.
70s. And today in 2020, 2021, 2022, it is, again, it's immigration and the skilled trades that are building Hamilton, that are building Ontario. And we've got some labor supply issues in which there are mass retirements coming. I mean, you'd be shocked if you walked around the average construction site as to the age of a lot of the people building. We need more immigration and we need skilled people that want to work hard.
And Mike, we got to run, but I mean, I really also, when I look at this, and this is a discussion that we could go on for hours, but somehow it seems that if we are this far behind and need this many housing units, I don't know, I don't understand what the permit process is like. I'm not in that world, but whatever we're doing, somehow we have to be expediting this to allow it to happen more quickly.
Scott, if I could sum up succinctly, when our population is growing faster than what we planned for, and the housing stock is growing slower than what we're planning for, we're going to end up with a housing shortage. And that's exactly where we are today. That's exactly why we are seeing prices going through the roof. And it's also why we're seeing a lot of families with children leaving the GTA, leaving Hamilton, and looking for more attainable housing in communities in Southwest Ontario. And that's where we're seeing a huge flow of people going.
For sure.
It's unfortunate.
Mike Collins-Williams, the CEO of the West End Home Builders Association, really appreciate the time today. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you, Scott. Have a fantastic evening.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Every once in a while, we hear a story, you hear the stories too, about someone, some people who deny the Holocaust. I mean, usually they're folks who know a little bit about what they're talking about, not the truth, but they've done a little research, they've done a little reading, and for whatever reason decided they don't believe it. But there could be other reasons, anti-Semitism or pure denial, whatever it is. But, and I don't know if this is a positive, they've at least come to their conclusion based on something. It may be warped, but at least it comes from something. And then today I see this story, and I got to tell you, it absolutely blew me away. Because it was a survey of grade 6 to 12 students across Canada and the States, mostly in Canada. It's by a Canadian group. And it was asking about the Holocaust. And what was stunning is not only the fact that, and we've known this for a while, that there is a real lack of knowledge. I mean, I'm not saying not really sure, a lack of knowledge about the Holocaust. 1 in 3 Canadian students, according to this, from grade 6 to 12, believe the Holocaust was either exaggerated or made up altogether. And 40% of our students say they learned about the Holocaust, not at school, not in a museum, not from any credible source, but through social media, which is, we know what social media is about. That's not going to be a good way to learn anything. Carson Phillips is managing director of the Neuberger Holocaust Education Center in Toronto. He joins us now. Carson, thanks for the time today. Appreciate this.
Oh, thank you for inviting me.
I read this story, I see these numbers, and the only conclusion I can come to is you're losing the battle. And not just you, but I mean, it just seems hopeless if this is what our kids are now thinking or learning or not learning.
Well, I probably have a little bit of a different spin on it than what the headlines and what the survey is saying. So, you know, an academic mentor of mine used to tell me that whenever you're reading or studying anything about the Holocaust, context is very crucial. It's a crucial element. And I would say that with some of the headlines and some of the analysis that I've seen coming out of this survey. I look at some, I have to say, I've only read the executive summary, which, you know, was emailed to me this morning. But I've noticed that some of these numbers are sort of conflated by adding together different categories to come up with a dramatic story. So one of the numbers about, you know, did the Holocaust happen? Well, 67% of the survey said it did.
Yes.
22% said they weren't sure. So that's really a different answer if you're not sure than saying it didn't happen. And when we look a little deeper into the survey and find that a lot of these were tweens, 13 years old, that's probably not surprising because it's not going to be part of their curriculum at age 13. And realistically, these are digital natives. They are online. They're accessing information, whether it's through YouTube, whether it's through online videos or social media like TikTok. This is not surprising. So I want to tell people not to be alarmed by some of these results. I think some of the headlines have really made it quite alarming and quite dramatic.
Carson, you say it's not part of the curriculum when they're tweens or 13, but my question would be, why not? Because I can guarantee you that in their curriculum this year, those same kids have probably talked in civics class or something about Black Lives Matter, justifiably, properly. They've probably talked about what's been discovered at the residential schools, properly. And yet, when you look at the numbers from Statistics Canada, the number one people group in this country that is the subject of more hate crimes than anyone else is Jewish people. And I'm
sure.
Just, so why would it not be part of the curriculum? That's the part I don't get. This should be an obvious one to be part of the curriculum.
And I think one of the reasons that comes out of this is that the Holocaust is a complex topic. It requires a lot of bridging. It requires a lot of historic grounding in the Second World War, as well as what had happened, you know, leading up to that. And so it's been part of the grade 10 history curriculum, where it is mandated to be part of. But we also know that there are many teachers across Ontario who are using, from grade 6 onwards, through language arts, through English, whether it's reading a book, maybe Hannah's Suitcase, you know, the Diary of Anne Frank, whether it's Elie Wiesel's Night. We do know that there are lots of curricular links where it is being used. Now, I'm not saying I'm against having a mandate for a younger grade level, but what I'm saying is that I know from the work that we do with, you know, over 20,000 school kids a year who visited our center before the pandemic, and still thousands who we interact with in our online programming, that we do know that there's a wide body of Holocaust literature, survivor talks, survivor testimonies as well, which are being used in these younger grades. So, you know, this is where I think we really have to balance this information of where we're getting it from, because it really would be unfair to say that it's not being covered in these younger grades. It is being covered, but whether that's mandated is another, that's another story, but it certainly does fit curricular links, and that may be learning from primary source documents, learning from witnesses to history, so that, you know, learning about literature. So, you know, it really does fit into many parts of the curriculum, and certainly is being done.
Yeah, the 40%, and again, I mean, look, you're right when these with these surveys that the majority still, as you point out, still say yes, the Holocaust happened. But it's one of those things, if we in this country, and look, I'm preaching to the choir here. I understand that. I mean, you work for the museum that teaches about this, but in this country right now, if a third of the people in this country said that we don't believe in COVID, people would say we've got a massive problem, because there is evidence, pure, perfect evidence that it happened. And yet we've got a third of them, whether they're not sure or they don't know, or, you know, this one just blew me away, that a whole bunch of these kids, or a number of the kids in the survey, learned about the Nazis and the Holocaust somehow through a Marvel movie. That was their introduction.
Yeah, but again, I think, you know, when we're talking about the age, whether someone's 12, 13, 14 years old, this is not surprising that this is where they're getting information on lots of topics, not just the Holocaust, but lots of topics. They're getting information digitally. And this is where education and us as a museum, we're in the process, you know, during the pandemic, we are refreshing our museum. We'll have a new, a new museum, which will be opening in 2023, taking this into account, that this is how young people acquire information, is in many cases through digital technology. And so, you know, the idea is to really harness digital technology for goodness and for educational purposes, rather than, you know, just saying, okay, so they're learning about this through digital media. Yeah, they are. So our job as educators is to harness that and to make sure that the information is getting there. And, you know, I'm really not surprised that younger kids say, I'm not sure it happened, because they're at an age where they haven't learned it in school. They may have seen something online. They don't know whether that's accurate or not, because maybe it was a movie, maybe it was an animation. And so they're really not sure. And that part, that curiosity, that is part of the learning process. And it's our job as educators now to really seize on that curiosity. And that, to me, is the most interesting thing that's come out of this survey, is that the overwhelming majority of young people say that they want to learn about it. So I think that's a real positive to come out of this with.
Yeah, I know. You know what? I love the fact that you are as optimistic about this as you are, because, boy, when I was reading this today, I was, as clearly you can hear it, I mean, I was not feeling optimistic about this, and, you know, was looking at this more as how do you keep this going? How do you keep this alive, the story, the history alive, when there seems to be such a struggle with that? Maybe it is. Maybe it's way better than I'm expecting it. But it's surveys like this that, boy, they do make you at least hope that we can continue to keep it alive.
You know, absolutely. And I would say, you know, with any survey, always dig deeper than the headlines, always dig deeper than the summary statement to find out. And like, I'll just give you an example, one which I saw, you know, which is listed in the summary: how did Hitler become Chancellor of Germany? And the correct answer, according to the survey, is that he was elected. And 38% had said, only 38% had said that. But that's actually an error. Hitler was not elected chancellor. He was appointed chancellor by von Hindenburg. So, you know, an older kid who's studying this in high school would have said, oh, that's not actually right, because maybe that's a trick question, because how did he become chancellor? He was not elected. He was appointed. And a kid who is really engaged in critical thinking will actually spend time and sort of look at these questions and wonder, what is this question asking me? And is perhaps there a different answer? You know, is this perhaps a trick question? So I am somewhat critical of surveys. I think you really do have to dig deeper into them to find out what is being asked, how it's being worded, how it's being framed. And, you know, is there a case of combining categories perhaps to say what we want it to say? Because when I read this, what I come away with it is that there's always room for improvement in the educational process, but that the overwhelming number of kids who were surveyed here said that they wanted to learn about the Holocaust and other genocides. And I think that's really a positive thing. The key to making that happen, you know, whether a mandate is something that one believes in or wants or not, that's another story. But a mandate is only going to be effective if teachers have resources and have training to be able to carry that out. Otherwise, it's a toothless mandate. So I'm very much about education, about providing professional development opportunities, and for really harnessing technology to really deliver meaningful, thoughtful, pedagogical material into the hands of learners to really grapple with these questions.
Carson Phillips, Managing Director of the Neuberger Holocaust Education Center in Toronto. I really appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this tonight.
Great. Thank you for having me on.
That is, look, I hope he's right. I really do. Because that is it's one of those things that you would hate to think that kids who are coming along are not as aware. Let's hope.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Let me bring in our good friend Steve Foxcroft. He is he comments on sports. He's a referee. He's an official. He may be thawed out finally after the last Buffalo Bills game at home. Not this weekend, but the weekend before when he was working the chains on the sideline. Steve, are you have you achieved full thawed outness yet?
I did. It took a while, and you know, the value of fireplaces comes into play after a game and a night like that.
See, I think I was wondering about your mental acuity, honestly, when I saw a picture, and people will remember, not talking about this game in Kansas City. You obviously didn't do that one, but the last one in Buffalo when it was so unbelievably cold, and you're posing for a bunch of pictures, and in every single one of them, you have no gloves on your hand. And I'm like, did this man get hit in the head during warm-up? What is wrong with him? Where are your gloves?
I was struggling. Correct. I did not have gloves. I can't. I have to write down information and work the downs box where when I've tried to do it with gloves in the past, it hasn't worked. I failed. So I have to go without, but I do go out locally and buy as many Hot Pockets as they'll sell me. And I use them. I jam my pockets full of them. And I needed them all that night.
I get you would. Yeah, you need something because when you say that you can't write with gloves on, yeah, but when your fingers are popsicles, you probably can't write too well either. I don't know if you'd recognize your own handwriting on your little book.
That's true. I'm going, this might not be legible. And also, that night, there was three or four situations where they did come to me looking for spots if they went back here and there, right? There was some close plays that we might have gone back to previous downs, and that's when they do come to me for that. So it all turned out for the good.
Okay, quick question for you on this one, because when we watch the games and it is blisteringly cold, nobody on the field gives the impression that they are cold. Do they tell you, hey, referees, even if your ears are about to fall off and you sneeze and it comes out as an ice cube, you cannot give the appearance that you're cold, look like you're having a great time? Do they tell you that?
Nobody, we do not get a memorandum from the league or the Bills or anything like that. It's every person for themselves, right? And that night it was every person. Sarah Thomas, the woman official, she worked with us on the crew that night. And she's from Louisiana. So she did have things. She was kind of shaking her head going, are you serious right now? How cold it is? So, and it you do lose your equilibrium a little bit. Like,
yes.
I remember Ryan Tannehill looking when he was in Miami, and I looked into his eyes, and he wanted to be anywhere but Orchard Park.
You it's a great point you bring up, because, you know, we think, oh, it's just cold. Go outside when it's severely cold for a while, even if you just are out there shoveling snow or something, and you do get a weird feeling. Like, you don't, it's not just cold. You don't feel normal after a while.
That's right. It's hard to function. It's hard to do your normal tasks, right? And I bet you, we talked to city workers that are out plowing the snows and all that. Kudos to them the last while as they've had their duties to perform. And they're not always warm and toasty in their trucks, right? They're out having to change the blades on the plow or something like that. It is tough. Or you outside doing your radio show.
Yeah, I don't do that. I'm a wuss. No, that would be ridiculous, because I, you know, I'm a man of great comfort. You know, I'm in my jammies in the basement and various layers. That's nice.
And like anyway. I said at the start, right in front of the fireplace.
There you go. All right, let's stick with the NFL for a second. We're not going to talk about the overtime rule because we've beaten that to death already. But, you know, in the last weekend, we lost out of the playoffs in the NFL two legendary quarterbacks, Tom Brady and Aaron Rodgers, both eliminated. And not just eliminated, but in both cases, there are now reports, discussions, whatever, that they may just decide that's it. They may be done. And here's my question for you, Steve. Let me say, neither you nor I are elite athletes, clearly, or we would not be talking right now. We'd be sitting at home in our $50 million mansions and, you know, whatever else. But if you had the choice and you could be Brady or Rodgers and say, I am going to leave at the top of my game, because both of them are MVP candidates this year. I'm going to leave the game while I'm still at the absolute top of my game, so I go out on top and people remember me for the greatness that I have been. Or do you say, you know what, I can still make $30 to $40 million a year playing quarterback. I'm still good enough at this. I might win a championship. I want to keep going. Which do you do?
I think they're going to keep going for different reasons. I think, first of all, let's say this. Brady and Rodgers, their fandom, people either love them or they hate them. Both of them.
Yeah.
For different reasons, but they love them or they hate them. But Josh Allen and Patrick Mahomes, everybody just loves them. You know, I don't think there's that. So I'll start with that, and then let's go back to the guys. I think they're both going to keep playing, and I don't even think it's close. I think it's 99% play, 1% that they'll retire. And the reason for that, I think Tom Brady will get it from his kids. His kids are now getting to the ages as they approach, like they're teenagers now or just about teenagers. And you could see when they showed them in the box, when they showed Giselle and the kids in the box, the kids ate it up. And I think they love the lifestyle of their dad being an NFL quarterback. So I don't think they're going to let him retire. So that's him. And with Rodgers, it's been forever since he, as you said, went out on top. Like, I can't remember when it was when they won. So I think he's still got a burning desire to be like a Brady or to even have the opportunity to go out on top. So,
yeah,
and I think he's still got skills.
And look, he does. I look at these guys. I mean, it is a sport. They're both healthy, but it is a sport where one bad play, your offensive line breaks down once and you turn the wrong way and you run into a 350-pound defensive end, bad things can happen. And, you know, if you've had the career they've had and you've got so much money in the bank that you could never spend it in your lifetime and you want to golf and they're both good golfers, I don't know.
Brady has adjusted his game to account for that. He rarely gets a big shot on him right now
because
he gets rid of the ball so quickly and at the feet of anybody. Like, he gets rid of it quickly. Aaron, not so much. And he's still, let's face it, he's a little more agile, right? That's part of his game and what he brings to the table for you. So I think he won't do that. But Alex Smith, right? He's kind of their vintage, and he got the broken leg, and miraculously did come back.
He almost lost his leg. I mean, and that's exactly what I'm talking about, is one bad hit and your life can be forever altered. And you know, Alex Smith, there was a documentary that was on TV. I can't remember. It was one of the sports things from ESPN. I mean, he very nearly lost his leg. Mm-hmm. And you think, okay, if I'm Tom Brady, I got 7 Super Bowls, I got how many MVPs and all the rest, I got all that money, I've got a wife who's making more money than I am, do I need to keep doing this?
And so I think that's the last thing that they think about. In our little list that we've come up with, the last things that are on that list is health, in terms of thinking that they'll get a catastrophic injury. Like, health, of course, you want to get through the season, you're always going to be banged up a little bit. But I mean something catastrophic, like that fracture of a leg or something like that. I think that's down on the list, as well as the money part. Like, the money is nice, but neither of them need it right now. You know, like, so I don't think that's as much of a part of their decision making as it is the other factors of possibly going out on top, possibly winning, possibly it's the only thing you've really known in your life as the calendar clicks along. Like, as they get towards July, they're ramping up for camp and all that. It's just what they know, right?
And all right. You said Patrick Mahomes a second ago. I want to jump in on this one for a second, because it is my opinion, and you said everybody loves Patrick Mahomes. I know one person who really likes Patrick Mahomes. That's Tony Romo. It's almost unlistenable watching on TV when Tony Romo is gushing over Patrick Mahomes. But here's the thing. I would argue that if you were, I believe wholeheartedly that Patrick Mahomes right now is the most overrated athlete in all of sports. I'm not saying he's not a good player. I'm not saying he's not a good player. He's a good player. But the way that he is described often, the way he is talked about as one of the all-time greatest of all time, greatest of the greats, no way. No way. And here's the other thing, Steve. I think if you were to do something in the NFL right now, and this is never done, but every player in the league suddenly was now disassociated from team. Everybody was a free agent, and the general managers were going to have a draft. Any player, you can draft everybody. Everyone is up for grabs, and it's not based on what you've done. It's not based on whether you'll be here in 5 years. It's for next year, right? It's what can you do for me just next season? I don't think Patrick Mahomes goes in the top 5 quarterbacks.
Wow. That's a big statement, but
Josh Allen would be ahead of him. Josh Allen would be ahead of him. If it was just for next year, Brady would probably be ahead of him. Mm-hmm. Rodgers would be ahead of him. Herbert might be ahead of him. I was thinking of
on some weekends, Dak Prescott from the Cowboys.
Prescott could be ahead of him for sure. Burroughs in Cincinnati could be ahead of him. I'm not sure that if it was just a restart. Like, you tell me this, the Buffalo Bills traded away the player that would have got them Patrick Mahomes. It was later that they drafted Josh Allen. If Kansas City came to the Buffalo Bills today and said, we'll trade you Mahomes for Allen straight up, do you think the Bills do it?
No, not right now. No, you don't do that now.
Not a chance.
No, not a chance. That's not even a question. Yeah.
I don't know.
Mahomes has been pretty, like, he was pretty good the other night. He extended plays and made the Bills DBs cover for such long periods of time. But here's the one thing, though. The final 13 seconds, it wasn't Patrick Mahomes pulling a miracle like it was the other way with Josh Allen. Like, Josh Allen on 4th and 4, he busted through and got a first down. On 4th and 13, he found a guy. And then the one that nobody talks about, the 2 points after the touchdown, we call it a 2-point convert. I say that in America, and they look at me like I got two heads. Like, what's a 2-point convert? Well, the point after touchdown, the one to Diggs that I thought was going into the third row, and all of a sudden Diggs goes up and gets it. Like, that was incredible. Then Patrick Mahomes saunters out, and he really didn't even have to do anything because, again, like, everybody's beaten to death, like you said, the Bills gave it to them.
The Bills' defense was exhausted. Look, my argument is not, again, my argument is not that Patrick Mahomes is not a good player. He's a really, right. really, really good player. But the discussion about him as one of the all-time legends of the game, to me, is so overdone. It's so overdone. And
I would also say it's premature.
Yes, it's been way premature.
Yeah, it's 4 years. Like, come on. And you got a great coach, and you got the Bermuda Triangle of Hill, Kelsey, and then Mahomes, right? Like, they're pretty okay. good.
I'll give you Kelsey because the Bills have Stephon Diggs, all right? So when you're comparing apples to apples here, take Tyreek Hill out of that Kansas City offense, and are we even talking about the Kansas City Chiefs playing on Sunday?
No, you're not. You're not.
No. But who would you take? So what's his name? Davis for the Bills. He was great. For mm-hmm. sure. But, you know, if he wasn't there, there were other guys. There's not one guy that Allen only has that he can go to bail him out. And that's right. You know, I just look at this and I go, the discussion, the over-the-top Tony Romo gush every time. So Patrick Mahomes throws a sidearm and Tony Romo's head explodes. Oh, look what he did. No one else can do that. And on the next sequence, Josh Allen does it, but he does it 20 yards longer, and it's never even mentioned. It's this Patrick Mahomes thing that I just don't get. I just don't get it.
And that's part of, I guess, it's they hype up the people that they know. So here's another thing that I'm going to give you. Next year, get used to seeing the Bills in prime time. We're all going to have to change our sleep schedules because the Bills are going to get a lot of 8:15 starts, at least four. I think the max is they're allowed is four.
Yes,
and they're going to get a lot of 4:15, 4:25 starts on CBS. So they're going to get prime time. And then maybe over time in the next 2 years, Josh Allen will become that, the love-in for Tony Romo and Chris Collinsworth and all them guys. Because let's face it, he got people's attention on Sunday.
Look, the difference to me is right now, and I'm going to say it a third time because someone's going to misconstrue. I'm not arguing that Patrick Mahomes is not a good player, but if you had a choice right now between Josh Allen or Patrick Mahomes, yeah. I'm not talking about pay. I'm not talking about Josh Allen does it better with his legs. He has the better arm. He has figured out how to get the ball into places that Patrick Mahomes got bailed out in so many ways by Tyreek Hill, and yet they somehow, and the Bills defense being gassed. I don't know.
The one guy we didn't mention too is Matt Stafford in our little.
Stafford was another guy that, yes, I would put him potentially there.
The highest you would go with Patrick Mahomes, to your point, you're not saying we're not bashing him here. We're just saying he's kind of got some extra attention. He's overrated right now. So
overhyped.
The highest he could go is fourth. The highest he could go. And that's behind Brady, Rodgers, and Josh Allen. But we just mentioned another five or six. So he's somewhere between 4 and 10.
I would agree. Yeah. And that is a weird thing when you consider
the gushing. The network national attention, eh? Like it is. It's frustrating, but I will say this, at least Tony Romo, the reason why he didn't gush as much about Josh Allen is because Josh Allen's performance was speechless. It left your jaw on the ground. So nobody could put a sentence together.
Let me ask you then, we only got a couple minutes left here, and I'm putting you on the spot because you did not know you were doing this when you came on today. You have to draft NFL quarterbacks in order, top five. Again, nothing to do with what you've done in the past, nothing to do with whether you're 45 years old and you may only play another year or not. For next year only, you have every draft is for a new year. For next year, you are drafting your team to give you the best chance to win next year. In order, who are your five quarterbacks that you take?
I'm going like Josh Allen, Brady, Rodgers. I'd take Drew Brees out of retirement. Dane Evans.
Yeah.
I love Dane Evans. No, and then probably like a Stafford or a Herbert or Prescott. Those are the next guys, I think.
Yeah, and Burrows even. Well, we'll see what Burrows.
Burrows is tough, eh? Like, he's one of those guys, like, for next year too. Like, I want to see more of him, because really, he really came into his own this year, but half of this year. You know what I mean? And he was banged up too. So
he has a knee.
Yeah,
he had his knee wrecked last year.
Exactly.
We're going to see something this year, this weekend, Steve. So let's say, and I don't think it's going to happen. I think Kansas City now, this is the curse of Buffalo. I think Kansas City now rolls to the Super Bowl championship because they've got that good a team, and everyone in Buffalo will look and go, yeah, we would have won. This was our year. But let's say that Cincinnati wins on Sunday. All of a sudden, what we're going to be hearing, Josh Allen, who just everyone for a whole week has been saying that was maybe the greatest game in NFL history, or in the argument, he will be forgotten, and now Burrows will be the future the quarterback of the future in the NFL.
Yeah.
It's the funny thing about this that our memories, we barely can remember what we had for breakfast.
Yeah.
And so whatever you see today, that's the greatest of all time.
That's so true. We live in a please me now society. And I know you got to run, but how about this as you go to break? This could be 2 years in a row after 50 whatever years, 2 years in a row, we could have a home team in the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
If the Rams.
Very possible.
Yeah.
Very possible. Like, I would think it is very, very likely, because I just don't see San Francisco beating them. But anyway,
right.
We'll sit here and debate the Patrick Mahomes thing down the road again. I never even got to the Baseball Hall of Fame. We were going to get to that, and we were going to get to the Chicago Blackhawks announcing that their general manager search is going to extend outside of hockey.
Right.
So good luck on that one. We're going to hire an accountant to do our...
Exactly. Yeah, the Sabres tried that, bringing in a soccer guy to be their head coach, and look where that happened.
Well, do you remember when the Ticats did this?
No.
Who did? When Ron Lancaster was general manager, Bob Young had just taken over, and Bob was an IT guy and a computer guy, and thought there must be a better way. And remember, he hired Rob Katz to be the general manager.
That's right.
And Ron Lancaster was his advisor.
Yeah.
And it was, we're going to think outside the box. And you know what? It was a brave idea, and it was an interesting concept. And since then, they've always had football guys as general manager, because, you know, you'd like to think that people who are, you know, they know something about the sport. However, we'll see. Maybe the Blackhawks will shock us all. And
they could be revolutionary this way. Hey, Scott, if you need them, I don't need them anymore. I got hot pockets if you need them, though, this weekend.
I may take you up on it. The house is chilly these days.
Sounds good.
Steve Foxcroft, always appreciate it. Thanks for doing this.
No problem. Talk soon.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.